let folks know they're listening to WORT 89.9 FM here in Madison, Wisconsin, WORTFM.org, or on the smartphone app. The show has been The Green Morning Radio. My name's Brian. So glad to have been with you. Have yourselves a good week. Of course, we got, that's the wrong theme. got a public affair starting up in just a minute after the BBC News, and I'll be back next week. Have a good one, folks.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says two Chinese citizens have been captured while fighting for Russia in Ukraine's Donetsk region. He says they were found with Chinese documents and bank cards, and he's demanded an answer from Beijing. Mr. Zelensky uploaded a video showing one soldier in handcuffs, speaking Mandarin, and apparently describing a recent battle. James Waterhouse is in Kyiv.
I think just hearing President Zelensky, you can see the political opportunity this provides. He, of course, is going to highlight what he sees as the broadening geopolitical footprint of Russia's invasion. And we don't know on what capacity these Chinese soldiers were fighting with Russia, if indeed they are Chinese. But if this is something more, and it is a big if, the consequences could be more significant, because China is interesting here. It's deepened its cooperation, its partnership, its economic ties with Russia, but it stops short of condemning its invasion. So we wait to see to what extent this relationship is stretching for Russia with its invasion of Ukraine.
The UN Secretary General has strongly condemned Israel's ongoing blockade of Gaza, saying that it violates the Geneva Conventions. Antonio Guterres said the floodgates of horror have reopened, leaving civilians in what he called an endless death loop. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
No supplies, humanitarian or commercial, have been allowed into Gaza for more than a month. The Fourth Geneva Convention requires Israel, as the occupying power, to ensure the population has food and medicine. Hospitals and health workers must be protected. Essential services like water and sanitation must be maintained. None of this, Antonio Guterres said, is happening in Gaza. He urged a renewal of the ceasefire. But he also warned the UN would not cooperate with Israeli proposals to take control of aid deliveries if they compromised the UN's core principles.
A roof has collapsed at a music venue in the Dominican Republic, killing at least 27 people. More than 150 others were injured. The accident happened during a concert by the veteran Dominican singer Ruby Perez. His daughter said emergency teams were trying to rescue him from under the rubble. At least 50 hippos and other large animals have died from suspected anthrax poisoning in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The head of Virunga Park said the animals were found floating along the Ashasha River. How they were poisoned is unclear, but anthrax is usually caused by bacteria found naturally in the soil. Metod Uhoze is the park's director of external relations.
We took the necessary measures to prevent the disease from spreading throughout the area. So far, we've managed to contain it within a specific zone, and continuous monitoring is currently underway.
World News from the BBC. The European Union's foreign policy chief has described attempts to break up Bosnia as unacceptable and warned that the EU would not tolerate them. Kaya Kallas was speaking during a visit to the Bosnian capital Sarajevo, with tensions in the Bosnian Serb part of the country at an all-time high. Kyrgyzstan's official Muslim governing body has backed the government's ban earlier this year on women wearing Islamic veils. The Spiritual Administration of Muslims of Kyrgyzstan said the burqa and the niqab were alien to the country's customs. It added that openly showing the face had a safety aspect, as a veil could hide someone intent on causing harm. Protests have taken place across some parts of India as a bill seeking to change how Muslim properties are managed comes into force. More than 10 petitions have been filed to the Supreme Court against the Waqf Amendment Act. Waqf is a charitable donation made by Muslims for the benefit of the community. But India's Hindu nationalist government says the process needs to become more transparent and legitimate. A makeup artist in Nigeria has been sentenced to 6 months in jail for abusing the local currency during his wedding ceremony. Abdullahi Musa Husseini pleaded guilty to the charge at the High Court in the northern city of Kano. Will Ross has more.
The music starts up, the bride and groom show off their moves, and the guests shower them in money. For years, this flamboyant gift, known as spraying, has been part of Nigeria's wedding culture. These days, with the sky-high cost of living, some naira notes never leave the guests' pockets. But another reason why newlyweds are seeing less cash is because the financial crimes investigator is locking people up for disrespecting the currency. In a country where for decades many politicians have been accused of looting the treasury, it's not surprising that some Nigerians are questioning whether the anti-corruption agency has got its priorities right.
Will Ross. And that's the latest BBC World News.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulator.
On today's A Public Affair, we're honoring the life and legacy of Bob McChesney, who passed away on March 25th. In addition to being a renowned academic and activist who fiercely advocated for independent media, McChesney was also a host on the show. In an obituary written for The Nation, John Nichols says that McChesney inspired generations of people to challenge corporate power and support a media reform movement that lives on. To pay tribute to McChesney and his legacy, today we're re-airing an episode of A Public Affair from December of 1995. You'll get to hear McChesney in conversation with John Nichols, who was then an editorial writer for the Cap Times and a national political writer for The Progressive. They talk about national and international politics and take listener calls. Though the conversation is from nearly 30 years ago, it feels surprisingly prescient. Because this is a rebroadcast, we won't be taking calls. But we hope you enjoy this slice of the WORT archive and extend our gratitude to the Wart Archiving Collective, who digitized this episode so we could air it today.
Hi, this is Bob McChesney on WORT. Today it's A Public Affair. And our guest today is John Nichols, the editorial page assistant editor?
Editorial writer.
Editorial writer, so you go by in your informal wart period here, for the Capital Times here in Madison, and also the national political writer for the Progressive magazine. Today we're going to talk about national politics, the 1996 elections with John, and also we'll talk about just global politics, because John just returned from a long trip to the Middle East and to Europe. If you'd like to call in and speak with John Nichols, the number is 256-2001. That's 256-2001. So please join us. All right. Welcome back after that interlude of music. John, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you back. You were our first guest here on the show.
It's my favorite show.
Right there. Well, we really got great ratings. In fact, this is Sweeps Week, which is why we brought you back, because I think you really kicked off the show for us well. Yeah. You just came back from England and Israel, is that right?
Yeah, I was in the West Bank, which I think, happily, we can now refer to as no longer, I mean, it's not really Israel anymore. I mean, the West Bank is rapidly becoming a Palestinian region under Palestinian control. There's a lot of debate about whether it's really making the shift as far as it can. But I was in Bethlehem right before Christmas and saw the Palestinian Authority take control there, and it's a very vibrant, very exciting time.
How's it working out?
There's an awful lot to complain about and a lot to be cynical about, because there's still not a real relinquishing of control on the part of the Israelis of everything, but there's no question that the Palestinians have at least some basic street-level control of these cities, and Arafat more or less is managing the transition with some political skill. I don't think we'll know for a couple of years how it's really working out, but we are seeing, I mean, this is a very dramatic shift. I mean, this is something that the world has been up in arms about, and it's been one of the central debates on the whole planet for the last 47 years.
Since the end of the war, really.
Well, yeah, and the Palestinian movement is a movement that, certainly got a lot of bad publicity internationally over the years, but is essentially a liberation movement, very progressive movement for the most part, a movement that promotes secularism and has been very inclusive of Christians, Muslims, even some Jews. So I think what you're seeing on the West Bank is one of a number of signs around the world of progressive movements having some success, and something that doesn't get wrapped into the American media too often.
Yeah, that's the next thing I wanted to turn to. How prescient. You know, in the U.S., if you read the U.S. media, and not just the mainstream or commercial media, but even the alternative media, independent media, there's a tone of sort of defeatism that, the big corporations and the wealthy and their ideologues completely dominate politics, and there's really nothing that can be done except to sort of go with the flow and make the best of it. And that this is a global phenomenon is what we're hearing, too, that around the world the message is the same. Everyone's sort of lining up to sort of cash in their chips in the marketplace and abandoning any ideals that aren't based on self-gain. Mm-hmm. Is this your experience from what you saw?
Well, I mean, I think it's a few years ago there was a article written by a guy named Fukuyama that suggested we had reached the end of history, that market economy was the only real answer to anything, and that sort of conservative market politics is going to define the world from here on out. And a friend of mine who's a member of parliament in England named Tony Benn was in India at the time, and he was in Calcutta. And somebody asked him about, this article on how we'd reached the end of history, that market economy, where we were at was where we're going to be from here on out. And he said, it was surprising to me this morning here in Calcutta that I didn't hear the poor in the streets of Calcutta rising up and saying, thank God we'll be poor forever. The point of that story is a very simple one. The suggestion that conservative market economy and the free market, et cetera, is going to define the world from here on out is an absurdity. We have genuine problems in the world, unsolved, unresolved issues, which were the very same issues that sparked the great social protest movements, socialism, social democracy throughout history. And a lot of those issues aren't resolved. And so when you look around the world, what's, I think, very exciting is that you see... you do see the forward march of history. You do see progress. One of the things, I look at the Soviet Union.
Yeah, give us some of the signs.
Look at the Soviet Union and Poland. In the last month, there have been elections in both of these areas. Well, not Soviet Union, Russia now. And there have been elections. And each one by what the American media tends to refer to as former communists. In fact, these former communists are, everybody in Russia is a former communist, by the way. Yeltsin's a former communist. Everybody in every party is a former communist, so that's an absurd definition. What the so-called former communists are really social democrats.
If you're a former communist who doesn't kiss corporate butt, then you're communist.
These are people, the people who are winning in Russia, in Poland, in Hungary, in Lithuania, all in lots of parts of the world, and also I would emphasize in South Africa, in Namibia, in parts of India where they've recently had elections. Are, we call them former communists. Let's be honest, what they are is they're socialists or social democrats. What they're saying is, we do not accept buying into a unrestrained free market economy. We think that there should be some government and that government ought to err on the side of working people.
Well, maybe if Steve Forbes doesn't win the presidency, he can go on a world tour and educate these dummies about the beauty of the free market.
Well, that's the thing. I think that there's an awful lot of people around the world that are having real questions about the free market. One of the most exciting things I saw when I was traveling was in France. I mean, France is alive
with
social
protests. Were you in France during all these...
Briefly, so I can't claim any expertise. I'm no more sophisticated than most people who would read, or follow the news or listen to some of the good programming here on Ward. I think the BBC...
It's not a fun drive week, so you don't have to go
to... But the BBC has covered this so well. I think the average American may not even be aware of what's going on in France.
This is a public affair on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. You're listening to a rebroadcast of a 1995 conversation between host Bob McChesney and John Nichols.
what's happened there is it ties so into everything that's going on. France is being pulled into the European Union, which is really kind of very GATT-oriented. Americans could reference it by NAFTA and things like that. And the French people have realized that by joining into these global trade agreements, which actually force a lot of changes on government, they're realizing that they're going to be forced to give up a lot of their social safety network, which is one of the best in the world. I mean, the French really do have created a very functional, humane society. And they're saying no. I mean, they've gone into the streets in the hundreds of thousands, even millions, and said, look, we are not going to accept a radical diminution of our social contract.
And I think the most important thing there might be that they've had success. I mean, that's the key lesson that Americans have forgotten, that if you organize, you win.
Well, exactly. In fact, in France, it's just a matter now of how far the French government, which is a conservative government, will back off.
But got elected on sort of a moderate left platform.
I mean, politics around the world is so mutant at this point that it's hard to say left and right sometimes. But the fact of the matter is that what they tried to do was to implement changes that a Newt Gingrich might be comfortable with. And what they've gotten, frankly, is a revolution in the streets. People filling the streets of Paris, unions doing what unions should do, which is when government attacks the interests of working people and poor people, instead of sending a lobbyist up to Capitol Hill, the unions in France went into the streets. Mm-hmm. And sometimes led by their rank and file more than the leadership. But the fact of the matter is that they've really shaken up the country. And the neat thing is that the social protests and social activism has now moved to Belgium. And they had, while I was traveling, they had about 100,000 people in the streets of Brussels, same kinds of protests. And what people are realizing and saying, much as the people in Chiapas in Mexico did a little over a year ago, they're saying, look, we don't necessarily have to accept agreements that are worked out in corporate boardrooms and on Wall Street to change our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that our lives may be imperfect, we may want changes, but we don't want the changes that Wall Street or that Steve Forbes are trying to put down our throat.
You're listening to WORT, a public affair. Our guest today is John Nichols, editorial writer for the Cap Times and also national political writer for the Progressive magazine. If you'd like to call and talk with John, please do at 256-2001. As I look over, I think the phone lines are open, so you're welcome to make a call. Today's Boxing Day. John, how did you celebrate Boxing Day?
Actually, I'm celebrating, and this is going to sound like a perverse political message, but I'm actually celebrating I think I'm going to go to the Gap and buy something.
I guess that's an American.
It's a very American thing.
What is Boxing Day? You've been to England, you can tell the masses of the United States what Boxing Day is.
Well, and you know as well, Boxing Day is a, in England, it's the day after Christmas, and in a good, well-set-up society, it's a day when people don't work. Instead of going rushing
traditionally,
back to
the workers and the servants had to work Christmas Day for their masters.
Right,
then Boxing Day was their day to celebrate.
Exactly, and so you get up and you and for the masters, it's where you box up all the presents you've gotten and put away because you don't really like them that much. But for the working people, it was a day of going out and having fun in the streets, singing, having fun. Yeah, it's a good day. But I actually brought the Gap for a good reason.
Okay,
the Gap is a which I say people should choose to buy their clothing wherever they like, but it's fascinating, and one of great successes for the American progressives just occurred last week. It was lost amid the Christmas rush. There's a thing called the Wisconsin Fair Trade Movement, and it's led by a lot of labor people, and it ties into a national fair trade activism. And they went after the Gap this Christmas season, and they said, look, you are getting a lot of your clothing out of El Salvador, and the people down there are being paid horrible wages and just being exploited in general, and this is wrong. And they leafleted outside Gaps, they protested at malls, they made a lot of noise, and a couple days before Christmas, the Gap backed down and signed an agreement saying that they will, on the people they contract with, the companies they contract with, they will enforce what will really be the highest standard in El Salvador. Now, that's still not high enough, and I'm not saying that's where we should be, but what happened was that working people in America have forced a real shift on the part of a major corporation in how they do business and made it to be more responsible.
That's a terrific victory.
It is a victory. And again, these kinds of things get lost In a lot of ways. I mean,
but
I don't
Dean even, Martin died. We have to cover the
Hey, Dean's stories. Dead. The Queen says that there's got to be a divorce. I mean, there's a lot of action.
It's
going
very
on.
Important. I mean, OJ's making a new video. I saw it too.
I have, you know, just an excitement about that that I can barely.
And Madonna's looking for a donor or
yeah.
something.
So. And so we'll just have to keep the stories of working people on for next year.
Well, if you'd like to talk with John Nichols. Oh, we have a caller. Is that right? You're on the air with John Nichols. Please go ahead.
Hello.
Hello. Yeah, please go ahead.
Hey, is this John Nichols?
This is John Nichols.
Hey, welcome back. This is Marge Williams.
Hi, Marge. How are you?
I'm so glad you're back.
One of our good readers.
Oh, yeah. God. A good writer. I was getting very paranoid, and I couldn't find you in the paper and was considering canceling my subscription.
No, don't do that. We need you.
Yeah. Oh, it was the best Christmas present I got to start seeing your articles again. I'm awfully glad you're back.
Well, thank you.
I'll hang up and let people with something important.
Oh, no, that's
no, he likes this
yeah,
call.
Yeah, these
Can
calls
tape
are...
It?
Marge, it's good to have you. And this is a woman who's a very, very good activist and all sorts of things here in town. So.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you for calling. The number, once again, is 256-2001 if you'd like to chat with John Nichols. And it looks like we've got another person on the line. Please go ahead. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi. You were speaking about the, you know, the gap earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And what a lot of people don't care to admit to, I guess, is that Ireland is pretty much a third world country when it comes to businesses also. And a lot of companies, and I'm heavily involved in developing things on the internet.
Okay.
And there is an internet provider, I believe in Dublin, that has their address as thegap.com. Mm. And when and GAP stands for something, and I forget exactly what, but the Gap is suing them for trademark infringement.
You mess with big corporations, right?
Yeah, yes. And I mean, and here is a service provider in another small third world country that, you know, I mean, these large corporations are dumping on.
Well, you bring up a good point, and that's that. I think that around the country right now, people like you and working people, labor activists and stuff like that, we have to accept that big corporations actually do define an awful lot of our lives, much more so, especially as bonds of community and family and that tend to get blown apart by a lot of the social changes going on. The corporations are very dominant, and people like you going on the internet, other folks going picketing at a mall, things like that, are really, I think, doing some of the most important work that goes on right now. You can go lobby Congress all you want, but the fact is that corporations tell Congress too often what to do. And so I think that it's very, very important today for people to celebrate successes like the fight that the fair trade folks had mm-hmm. with Gap, but also to pay attention to what corporations are doing, because this is how we ultimately, I think, get some balance back in our system.
You know, John, I'd like to, if I can, shift the discussion a little bit to the presidential race, because we wanted to talk about that. Could the Republican field, it really looks like an extraordinarily, I mean, it really... earmarks the Republicans as an even lamer political party than I thought they were as I've watched them on C-SPAN. What's your take on the Republican field right now?
Well, for years I've always said, you know, like I was raised in rural Wisconsin, and so I've always thought of myself as a Republican. And, you know, I'm a little disappointed in my party. This is the party of Bob La Follette and of a lot of Teddy Roosevelt, a lot of relatively progressive folks. Right now, those people wouldn't be able to recognize what's going on in the Republican Party. There was one relative moderate running, and that was Arlen Specter, which is bizarre to call this guy
really
moderate,
is.
But his labor record was actually better than Clinton's.
Still is bizarre to call him
moderate. But he just, I mean, here's an example. This is a guy who is running basically saying a lot of the things that George Bush said in 1980, that Gerald Ford said, that you know, mainstream Republicans of the past said, and he could not get above 1% in the polls and among Republican activists. He couldn't raise money. He finally just ditched it. Well, this is a pretty scary sign. I'm not saying that anybody has to get excited about the Republican Party, but we ought to have a functional Republican Party with some breadth within it. We don't. I mean, the party is actually defining over to a fight between the people who want the Republican Party to exist solely to benefit big corporations, and those who want it to exist to benefit big corporations and to impose a sort of theocracy on America.
That seems to be the split in the party.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a, so it's sort of like a split between, do you want a sharp stick in the eye or a relatively blunt stick in the eye? You know, it's a very frightening thing going on, because ultimately, the way that our system's working right now with Republicans and Democrats, the Democratic Party, I always think that the political spectrum's like a tug of war. And if you've got people on the left pulling hard, people on the right pulling hard, you get something in the middle that may actually reflect both. At this point, the left isn't pulling very hard. The right is pulling like crazy. And they are pulling the Republican Party far over to the right, but they're also pulling the Democratic Party mm-hmm. over to the right, because people like Clinton, they look and they say, well, hey, the Republicans are all way over to the crazy extreme, so I can play in the middle ground. I can play, you know, in the so-called middle between, you know, what used to be moderate mm-hmm. and conservative. And I think the whole spectrum is being, the whole political spectrum in America is being pulled far to the right.
All right, you're listening to John Nichols here in a public affair, WORT today. If you'd like to call and talk with John about politics, we're about to talk about the 96 presidential and congressional races. Please call us at 256-2001. The conventional wisdom right now, John, is that Bob Dole is the leader in the Republican side. He has most of the major politicians, lots of the big donors.
Certainly does here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think around the country.
And around the country, too, yeah.
He's lined up a lot of the career politicians. He seems to be in the lead. Traditionally, though, interesting, those front runners oftentimes don't fare that well once you get into the primary situation. What's your sense with Dole?
Well, it's a unique dynamic. You got to remember, the Republican Party is a little different than the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has, for all of its many faults, has a lot more democracy inside its process. The Republican Party, if you line up a lot of the leaders, you've got a really good shot at making it. And I think that Dole comes out, frankly, as the winner of the pre-campaign in 1995. I mean, Dole came out very, very well. He did line up a lot of this leadership. They're using, you know, arcane ballot laws in a lot of states to keep other people off the ballot. Even Pat Buchanan is screaming about democracy.
Yeah, in New York State, he's been knocked off the ballot.
And so, I mean, I think Dole's in pretty good position to become the nominee. And frankly, from a progressive standpoint, I'd say that's better than some of the alternatives.
Yeah.
I mean, he's better than Graham. He actually grew up poor, which is an intriguing thing.
He won't die poor, though, apparently.
No, I don't think so. And I think it's always a little bit risky to say he grew up poor, so maybe he'll be a decent guy, because I think that's what we said about Clarence Thomas.
Yeah, well, Phil Graham apparently flunked all his school courses and was real poor, he claims, too.
Well, if we're going to dish on the Republican candidates, I mean, it's like an endless thing. I mean, this is an amazing thing. Dole is the only guy running who didn't dodge the draft. I mean, it's true. I mean, the rest of them dodged the draft.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
It is amazing.
If you had to go to like some sort of like SDS meeting in the 60s to find this many draft dodgers in the same room. And, you know, when you get up there and they have a debate, it's like, it's an amazing thing. Because, you know, here they're all like, you know, they're for security and they're for all this stuff like that. Well, they're also for morality and that. Well, half of them are divorced, you know, and in surreal, sleazy divorces. The other half are, you know, draft dodgers and they all like got kicked out of school. I mean, this is a pretty sordid bunch of folks. And frankly, quite honestly, in comparison to some of the rest of them, Dole does come off as, you know, statesmanlike, which is bizarre because he used to be the bad boy of American politics.
Yeah, one person has been making a lot of waves recently is this guy, Steve Forbes, the heir to the Forbes magazine fortune, who is spending a good deal of his considerable wealth running ads attacking Dole and Phil Graham for being career politicians.
Right, right.
And making the case for free market economics. Sort of a Jack Kemp style guy in the sense that he puts a happy face on this.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of talking about reaming people, he talks about how everyone can be rich as long as the government bureaucrats are farmed out.
Yeah.
Do you think Forbes will have any impact with all this money he's spending?
Oh, he's having a profound impact already. I mean, there's no question. I was up in New Hampshire a couple of weeks, right before I went overseas. And in fact, I'm going to be back there next month to do some stories for the Progressive and for the Cap Times. There's no question that that Forbes is buying a place in the presidential campaign, and it's really quite remarkable. The guy is dropping money. I mean, I don't know. We've got a good technician here from Wart. So I know Wart's community sponsored. So you don't have advertising, but you know, do you know?
We have business sponsorship.
How much money comes up?
Creative underwriting.
How much underwriting comes up in a week here? Give me a number.
What do you mean? How much?
Money wise.
Creative underwriting or.
There's a point to
it. It's not all that creative. It's a statement about the business, yeah. You know, that's not really a part of it, the fact that they're both being philanthropic and supporting the programming.
Terrific.
But it's a very straightforward, simple announcement. Mm-hmm. And some of it is cash, some of it is trade out for goods.
But I'd say maybe
a couple grand at the most.
A couple grand a week. Okay, that's why. The reason I bring that up is that you get a couple grand a week here, and you get some, you know, get a lot of community support, which is vital. And you support a station. Well, Steve Forbes on little radio stations that don't have nearly the listenership of Wart in New Hampshire is dropping 60,000 and 70,000 a week.
A week?
A week into these stations.
This is a public affair on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. You're listening to a rebroadcast of a 1995 conversation between host Bob McChesney and John Nichols.
It's just incredible. You cannot turn on the radio.
All Forbes all the time.
That's right. Exactly. You cannot turn on the radio. I was up in New Hampshire. It's the most amazing thing. You get in your car, and I mean, you turn on the alternative station, you turn on the rock station, you turn on the country station. It doesn't matter. It's Steve Forbes all the time. And I mean, he's like on with these, like, you know, happy talk messages. But the fact of the matter is, he is showing that, you know, you drop $60,000, $70,000 a week on every station the size of Wart in the state of New Hampshire, which is about 15 of them. And you just buy TV,
mm-hmm.
You can do something. He is now in second place in the polls.
Well, my sense has always been with these right-wing politicians, and Reagan showed this too, is that Reagan really made his move when he put the happy talk spin on right-wing policies about how it's going to be so great for people. And Kemp did that, and I think that this is what Forbes' appeal is. You know, what you have with these guys like Graham, who just look like jerks who want to screw you over, is people say, you know, what's the happy talk here?
But I think this is a lesson for the left, too. And I think it's very important. You know, too often the left is very dark and, you know, everything's awful and it's a brooding, awful time. People, ordinary folks, want to believe in something positive. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be told that, you know, you ought to vote this way because if you don't, you're going to have death and grief and sorrow.
Yeah.
You know, and what we're going to give you is a happier version of death and grief and sorrow. I mean, what people need to offer messages that are positive. And Forbes understands that. I think that his message ultimately isn't positive for ordinary folks, but he knows how to market.
I agree.
And I think that progressives ought to take a good gander mm-hmm. at that and realize that our message ought to be progressive as well, or ought to be happy and hopeful as well.
Well, let's turn to that in a sec. But first, the phone lines are filling up here. If you'd like to call and speak with John Nichols, please call 256-2001. In the meantime, let's go to the lines here. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, I'm curious about Mr. Nichols' trip to Israel.
Yeah, hi.
Hello. It seems, you know, there's probably a flurry of military activity in the area, and I'm wondering what your sense of the Israeli press is, if you get any chance mm-hmm. to look at that, their opinion is about this entire thing, about all this military activity.
Particular military activity by who?
Well, there's a lot. Well, even today, there's a story in the paper about Turkey actually. A fundamentalist is.
Right. Yeah. That's...
And then there's a story about the Turks actually. Are going to train the Bosnian army.
Yeah, that's a little separate from Israel.
But yeah, right. But I wonder what their press is thinking, what their public opinion is. I mean, is there a Palestinian press yet?
There's a very vibrant Palestinian
press. John, why don't you give us the run? Thank you very much, caller.
Okay.
John, why don't you give us the rundown on what the Israel press and Palestinian press is like?
Well, that's the thing. The Israeli press is pretty vibrant and pretty wide open. I think much more ideologically diverse than the American press.
Noam Chomsky always argued that you got a much more sensitive reading of Palestinian issues in Israel than you did in the United States.
There's no question. I mean, we in American media, we tend to turn everything into a cliche, and a very simplistic cliche at that. In the Hebrew press in Israel, you're going to get a real good, diverse sampling of views because the Israeli political spectrum is very, very broad. Their Knesset, which is their parliament or Congress, stretches from militant right-wingers who are they're well to the right of Newt Gingrich, all the way over to communists. And their media reflects a lot of that. What's exciting to me is the Palestinian press, which is pretty vibrant. They have some challenges. I mean, Arafat is not perfect. He's, I think, you know, like many new leaders, he's trying to have a little power over the press and let them know what they should and shouldn't say. Mm-hmm. But frankly, a lot of the reporters and a lot of the editors aren't you know, taking the cue. They're really publishing some pretty challenging stuff. Edward Said here in the States has published some real challenging stuff, and a lot of that has been reprinted. Mm-hmm. And
so it's a pretty vibrant political culture.
I tell you, I love being in the Middle East, in Jordan, less so in Jordan, but certainly in the West Bank, Gaza, and in Israel, because you just every day there are political discussions which are much more engaged and mm-hmm. much more excited. People take very seriously.
Is there anywhere less political in the United States? I mean, have you been to somewhere like, you know, some island in the middle of the Pacific? I can't wait to get back to the U.S. and really get engaged politically.
I have never been any place where politics is taken less seriously than in the United States. Yeah. And I think that part of it is, you know, John Kenneth Galbraith wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Culture of Contentment.
Yeah, a masterpiece, I might add.
It's a wonderful book, which is not taken too seriously in the U.S., but everywhere else in the world it's viewed as sort of like almost a biblical significance.
Well, my students take it seriously or they fail.
Well, that's there you have it. But Galbraith argues that America, you know, is essentially a contented country, and so we don't pay much attention to things. And the real question that Galbraith asks is, how long can our contentment last?
He suggests not very long.
I hope that he's right, because I think that being contented and just accepting things as they are is terrifying. I mean, let me just give you a quick example. I heard on the radio, retail sales were down, right, at Christmas in the retailing market. They're all excited and concerned and scared. Well, one of the reasons they said they were down is because people's incomes, their real incomes, have been absolutely flat or declining since 1990. And they're saying, yeah, it's finally caught up with us that people's lives aren't getting any better. They're not making any more money, and so as a result, they can't constantly buy more toys at mm-hmm. Christmas. Well, I mean, that ought to be a signal. We're sort of like, I always think of us as sort of like the frog sitting in the slowly warming water. You know, they always mm-hmm. say if a frog is thrown into hot water, he'll jump out. But if you put a frog into kind of warm water and then heat it up, he'll boil.
Well, that might be the difference between France and the United States with regard to these slashes. You know, we have a couple of very generous people who have been waiting patiently to speak with John. Let's turn to the lines again. You're on the air with John Nichols, and thank you for waiting.
Is this me?
Yes, it's you.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Fine.
I have a number of questions, John.
Sure.
And you very correctly pointed out that the left has been asleep while all this was happening. I put it to you that it was more than asleep. It was pushing a Republican agenda, just like Cap Times did by endorsing Klug in the last elections. In
perhaps not our highest moment there. Eh?
this is a very serious, of course, matter to all of us. I'm more interested in the local elections rather than the presidential elections, and I believe that the Congress is really the thing that the left can concentrate on beating, not the presidential election, because I don't see much difference between Clinton and Dole.
Caller, I think you make a really good point, and I think I'm saying that the congressional elections are critical to pay attention
right.
to this year. Yeah.
In your opinion, how can Klug be beat?
That's a great question. That's something I wanted to ask too. So,
okay, and I think this is a really good question to be asked right now. And I think that progressives in Madison
I guess a caller left us, but he's hopefully still listening.
I love a caller that asks a question, and then although I would have liked the caller to stay on because we could have talked about it. But I can tell you this: I think that Scott Klug's position is weakened now. More than it has been in a long time.
Yeah. Let's start one thing we've talked about, John, off the air. I mean, Klug is a really good politician. People have got to start to understand they're not dealing with just a blow-dry guy here.
Yeah, I think that this is one of the things that progressives in Madison have been, you know, really, you know, way off the mark on. They think Klug is stupid, or that he's like some kind of TV personality, doesn't really know what's going on. I talk to Scott Klug a lot. This guy is a very, very bright, capable, charming guy, which I think politically makes him much more threatening
Absolutely.
Than if he was an idiot. I mean, the fact of the matter is Scott Klug is a skilled politician, and he's played the game very well, and he's benefited by the fact that when the Republicans weren't in the majority, he was able to basically say, you know, I represent all the good things about Republicans, but none of the bad things. And a lot of Madisonians said, well, what the heck, that's fine. And Klug's opponents weren't strong enough to really... They had money, but they didn't seem to have the ability to deliver a message.
Yeah.
And so Klug was able to get away with a lot. Now, heck, just in the government shutdown, he was the man who wrote the resolution that effectively ended up continuing the government shutdown by refusing to compromise. And Gingrich wanted to compromise with Clinton, but a sector within the House Republican caucus refused, and Kluge actually wrote, you know, he was sort of their ringleader.
Well, I thought he was supposed to be Joe Moderate, though.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is this is one of the great lost realities. We have this discussion that suggests that you're a moderate if you favor abortion rights. That's about, in the Republican Party, that equals moderate and nothing more. Just, you favor abortion rights, you're a moderate. If you don't, you're a conservative.
Yeah.
Well, the fact is, that's about where it's at. Scott Kluge is relatively good on abortion rights. Some people complain about certain aspects of it, and I think it's a debate that can be had, but he's more moderate than many Republicans on abortion rights. But on economic issues, this man is extremely conservative. And
well, he's a corporate Republican.
Well, yeah. It's an aggressively conservative Republican. There are actually Republicans from upstate New York and Massachusetts, some other areas, who are really pretty moderate on economics. They want unions to be strong. They favor OSHA, things like that. Scott Kluge has really defined himself into a pretty much of a far right sector on some of these economic issues, and it'll be interesting to see how the campaign plays out, but I do think that that's going to start to bite him a little bit.
Will this show up in the sort of funding Kluge gets, the donations his campaign next year?
He's already one of the most successful fundraisers in the country. He can. The fact of the matter is, Scott Kluge can raise as much money as he needs,
mm-hmm.
And it will come a lot from telecommunications, a lot from healthcare.
He's been their point man on the Hill.
Sure, absolutely, frankly, I mean, that's just a reality. I mean, you accept that the money's going to flow to Scott Kluge's campaign.
Can anyone beat this guy?
Yeah, this is the thing that I think is significant, and I think that Democrats, progressives ought to be talking about these issues right now. There's one guy who's running. His name is Gene Farley, and he's a really decent fellow. He's a physician. He's former head of one sector of the medical school at the university. Very articulate, very bright, very capable fellow. And he's working hard, and he's got some support. I don't know whether anybody else is going to jump into the primary and try and make a run. I've always said that Scott Kluge is probably most vulnerable to a really vibrant, and I've personally always thought it should be a woman, but to a really vibrant, aggressive, kind of Russ Feingold-style economic populist.
Yeah, it seems like you've got to hit him where he's weak.
Well, you got to talk. I mean, you're not going to win by saying, well, I'm a moderate, and Scott's a moderate, and I'm a better moderate than he is. You're going to beat Scott Kluge by saying, Scott Kluge is a conservative, I'm a progressive, and let's duke it out.
Yeah, it seems like the campaign in California that drew a lot of attention, where Tom Campbell won the House seat, where they tried to say, well, here's a moderate Republican, but if you vote for him, you're voting for Newt, because he'll vote for Newt for Speaker. That's not going to be good enough. I mean, you've got to talk about the actual candidate, not Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, because we're not a British parliamentary system. I mean, it's not like if you vote for, Americans don't think that way, even though it's a good argument.
Yeah.
Americans don't think, well, if I vote for this guy, I'm going to get this party and this set of views. Yeah. Instead, they really do still think on the local level, and they may say, well, I kind of hate Gingrich, but, you know, Scott Kluge came to my kid's school, and he was a nice guy, and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I think we've got another caller on the phone lines who's been extremely patient. Caller, please go ahead. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah.
And thank you for waiting.
Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for waiting.
I think when you look at the upcoming race with Kluge and whoever, we need to remember then that Kluge, of course, is not a dumb right winger, and unlike Wellstone or Feingold, who were lucky enough to have people, an idiot like Boschwitz or a marginal person like Kasten to run against, this Democrat is not going to have somebody like that. You know, Kluge is something. Perhaps it would be helpful if we could ever find out what Kluge was actually doing with most of his time, when he had that part-time sports announcer's job in Washington for several years.
You think he was being trained to be a candidate?
What sort of right-wing candidate school he was going to would be interesting for some of us to know.
Well, you know what I would say, though, that's worthy of noting is that as regards to right-wing candidate school, right now Scott Kluge is the right-wing candidate school. This is sort of one of the lost...
Isn't he training?
It's a very lost loss on the discussion in Madison. I think it's absolutely fascinating. When conservative candidates are nominated by the Republicans to run, say, in a district in Wyoming or Texas or something like that, they bring him out to Washington, and Scott Kluge and a couple other people in the so-called Republican Congressional Media Caucus or something along that line, actually sit down with these guys and teach them how to do TV and media and how to come across as sensible and moderate and stuff like that. And so, now, Scott may have gotten some training along the way, but I'll tell you, this guy is very good. I think, to be honest, he's the guy who's doing a lot of the training.
Yeah.
Well, there has been some writing in some of the left media, the real far-left media in this country, about how Kastenmeier was specifically targeted, and they put up somebody as good as they could against him and did beat him. And it was because Kastenmeier, of course, being on the Intelligence Committee, was a decent and honest fellow who was blocking some of the more nefarious stuff that intelligence agencies of various types were up to. And then, John, I wanted to talk just a little bit about Buchanan. You know, it's kind of interesting that Buchanan is crying about the lack of democracy in the Republican Party. And I guess we have to remember that before they got into power, Buchanan's favorite political heroes also cried about how there wasn't really any democracy in the systems they were dealing with. Pinochet said there couldn't be any real democracy if Allende was the democratically elected president.
Well, you're right.
His other political hero was saying similar stuff before he took over.
Which one is it?
That being, of course, Francisco Franco in Spain. A guy who has these kind of political heroes.
Well, no, I mean,
but at least, might I say, Pat Buchanan is starting to make some sounds as if he even has some sensitivity to the fact that there's been this 25-year decline in purchasing power. You know, isn't it a travesty that the Democrat Party is not coming up with anybody that complains about this?
Well,
they have a president who even pretty much has been somebody going along with that whole part of the system.
There is one
Buchanan talks about.
There is one economic populist running for president right now, and that's Pat Buchanan. It's a scary thing because his economic populism is, I think, insincere and very limited. He's not pro-union.
Hitler was an economic populist, too, when he ran.
Well, but you see, the thing is that Buchanan's not pro-union.
That's where it falls apart,
in my mind.
The litmus test to be a populist.
But you're absolutely
unions.
Right. That there's no question that Buchanan is the one out there talking about NAFTA, about GATT, about declining living standards, about how America needs to redefine itself to be more oriented toward manufacturing and toward having a good basic economy. And it's bizarre that there's no Democrat saying that. That should be the Democratic Party's
but
message.
But one last question. This is not the issue that Democrats may feel they have any real chance on, because the other thing in our system that's been very successful is that the system has really been set up so that the people that we're talking about, whose wages are declining, they've been very successful getting those people not to vote, making it difficult. The most stressed people in our society are the least likely to vote. You know, you have a situation, I guess, in New York City where not many years ago, a poor person had to lose 2 days of pay in order to register to vote, and very few of them did. Mm-hmm. They've set this system up. I guess the Tuesday elections is another factor,
sure.
Is it not?
Well, we should have mandatory voting in the United States. Everybody should be required to vote.
You think so, John?
I absolutely do. And then they want to go and burn the ballot in the ballot box if they want to, you know.
This is a public affair on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. You're listening to a rebroadcast of a 1995 conversation between host Bob McChesney and John Nichols.
Tear it up, do whatever, that's fine, but everybody ought to have to come in and do it, because the fact of the matter is that it's, if you don't, it's sort of like taxation. If you don't, if you allow for loopholes to get in, any kind of loopholes, eventually the rich are gonna get all the loopholes in. Well, it's like that with voting. If you say, well, we can't make people vote, you know, we got people, everybody should have the freedom to do what they want, ultimately they're gonna figure out ways to discourage the vast majority of working and poor people from voting, and that's what happens in America. And I'll give you the example of Australia. Australia requires you to vote. If you don't go vote, you get a fine that goes on your taxes. If you do vote, you get like basically $96 off your taxes. Well, they have 98-99% turnout. The only people who don't vote are those who have religious, like Seventh-day Adventists. Some religious groups don't vote. But essentially, everybody votes. And
but there's another point.
Well, let me finish my point, which is that the Australian political system, their far right is about where the Democratic Party is in America.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know you can't get by playing to a small audience. You've got to play to the whole country. When you play to the whole country, you get a much more democratic system.
But, John, the other thing they have in Australia is they have a measure of proportional representation.
Right, which we should also have, yeah.
If somebody like me votes, I may have some assurance that somebody with political ideas not terribly distant from mine will at least be in the parliament to raise some hell. You know, I don't even have that in Bernie Sanders in this country. You know,
you're closer with Bernie than with most, but I understand. Well, you know, you got some people in the Congressional Black Caucus. I mean, we have some progressives, and I don't think we should underestimate that. But you're right, proportional representation would be wonderful.
When the fact that Jesse Jackson Jr. was elected,
good guy.
You know, yeah, that's shocking. But you know, when you think about it in terms of democracy, is it not a tragedy and a travesty that somebody like Jesse Jackson Sr. has not been in our national legislative body for he should have been in there for quite a few years, as perhaps but I guess we got with somebody like Dorland, we got the people.
Yeah, we got the other
side. The Luliest right.
Well, if we had an equivalent on the left of what we got on the right in Congress, we'd have Noam Chomsky. You know, he'd be in there. We'd have, you know, all kinds of people. We'd probably have Bob McChesney in Congress.
Well, I don't think we'd slip that far. Caller, thank you very much for calling. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
We only have a few minutes left, John. And let's talk about the Nader phenomenon, because I know we were chatting about that off the air. Ralph Nader is going to be on the ballot, I understand, in California for the Green Party, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And what's going on there? Because this hasn't gotten much press coverage.
No,
so
it's sort of an amorphous thing. And again, it's a part of how we cover politics in America. We don't talk a lot about what's really going on. But it's probably one of the more exciting things that's happening right now is the Green Party has ballot status in California. So they got a presidential line that they can fill with anybody's name,
mm-hmm.
anybody that they nominate. Nader has apparently agreed to take the line. That doesn't mean that he's running for president of the United States, but what it means is he's going to offer a viable alternative in California. And as I understand it, what Nader really wants to do is use it as an organizing tool to go out, tour around a lot, maybe get involved in some debates and that, and spread the word on a lot of social democratic consumer issues, which I think are real important, NAFTA, GATT, things like that. What I think, though, and what I hope, is that Nader doesn't stop at California. We have a perverse coastalization of our society where people think that they're really, you know, they got their finger on the pulse if they do something in California or New York or someplace like that.
Talk to a cab driver.
Yeah, exactly. I hope that Nader comes out here to Wisconsin. The new Progressive Party in Wisconsin, our third party, which is very viable and has had a lot of success here, is on the ballot. They have a presidential line next November. And why shouldn't, if Ralph Nader is going to take the green line in California, why not take the new progressive line in Wisconsin? Why not take the green line in Maine and New Mexico? Why not take the new party line in Arkansas? I mean, there's a bunch of states.
Would you be concerned, though, that he would take votes away from Bill Clinton and then lead to a Republican victory?
American voters are much smarter than they're given credit for by political analysts. And I have no question whatsoever that if there was a race between, say, a Bill Clinton and a Phil Graham, that when it got down to dust in the final analysis, voters would, you know, they wouldn't throw their vote away if they thought that it was going to put a Phil Graham in the White House. I don't think progressive voters would do that, except maybe some who are so frustrated and really genuinely believe that it doesn't make a difference. And I just think that alternative is needed. It's healthy.
How important is it in the near to long term that there be another political party and one to the left of the Democrats? A national organized political party to represent working people. Is that, or should we stick with it, or does it not matter? We can do it with the Democrats.
Yeah,
What's your view?
I think it's. I'd like to have another party. I think that most democracies around the world have three or four parties. Germany, England, even, you know, Canada has four parties that are working pretty hard. Five if you count the Quebecois. So I mean, I think America could use another party, and I'd like to see it get in there. I don't care if the Democratic Party moves left and they start a new centrist party with Tsongas and all those guys and then let the Republicans be the far right, if the Democratic Party becomes the middle party and you form a new party to the left, I don't really care what you call it. But I do think that we ought to have you know, a
so then
you, right
this
left
leader thing is a good thing, do you?
I think it's healthy as
great.
Well. Yeah.
We have just a minute and a half left, and I want to. We have one caller on the line. Caller, please go ahead with John Nicholson. I'm terribly sorry to have made you wait.
That's all right.
Hey, thanks for calling.
It's all been quite interesting. I think the previous caller is a good indication why people don't vote in this country, because they don't get any information about the candidates. Kastenmeier is a really good example of how the Democratic Party is like the Republican Party. His prime committee assignments when he was a congressman and in his power as a senior member, or one of the senior members of the majority of the House Judiciary Committee, was a committee that had oversight of the federal prisons. And he never cracked a grape from keeping them from building his gulag. His other important and well-known committee assignment was on patents. And his work made sure that no inventor would suffer at the hands of any corporation. This is a really middle-of-the-road guy who took bold peace stands at the very beginning of his career and strung it out for 30 years till somebody came along who could effectively campaign. Neither one of them. I mean, the job is no longer got anything to do with the campaign. They're pretty much divorced. They're separate issues, and they need to be looked at as separate issues. And the second thing is Australia. And what the lesson is in Australia was that when the Australians got crosswise with the Americans, within 2 years, the Americans had thrown out the Australian government, and they had to get another one. That was the government of Gough Whitlam.
You're exactly
took
right.
A whole bunch of anti-Vietnam War stands, pulled his troops out, began calling the Americans names, released the people from the Australian prisons who were serving time for draft dodging, and on and on and on. And the CIA started a two-year campaign in which they got rid of Whitlam and his government without a vote.
I'm telling you, only in Madison do you get such astute callers.
Thank you. What a nice thing to say.
I wish you called earlier because we unfortunately were running out of time now, caller, and I'm afraid we have to pull
thanks a lot
here. Well, thank you for calling.
Good call.
John, we have to go in a few seconds. Any last comments to the listeners of Madison?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, it's like the Christmas season and all, and I would suggest to folks that be hopeful. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff happening around the world. Progressives aren't doing nearly as badly as they think, and I think 96 could really be a good year.
So everyone keep reading John Nichols and the Cap Times and the Progressive. I'm Bob McChesney here in A Public Affair. We'll be back in 3 weeks right here with Katha Pollitt, columnist of The Nation. And I'd like to thank Sybil, who's engineered us today, and Lou, who's answered the phones, for cooperating and helping out. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to A Public Affair. And this has been a rebroadcast in honor of the life and legacy of media scholar and activist Bob McChesney. Thanks to the WORT Archiving Collective for digitizing the show. Thank you to our sound engineer John, receptionist Steve, and news director Shelley Pittman. I'm Sarah Gabler, and I produce this show. Stay tuned for Letters in Politics on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street Morning Afternoon Edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listener supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen to supported.
Michael Maria.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back.
the apathetic bullshit and send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pipe.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show,
jobs and factories will come roaring back into our country, and you see it happening already. We will supercharge our domestic industrial base. We will pry open foreign markets and break down foreign trade barriers. And ultimately, more production at home will mean stronger competition and lower prices for consumers. This will be indeed the golden age of America. It's coming back. We're going to come back very strongly.
The global financial markets are reeling as the world braces itself for a trade war initiated by President Donald Trump's sweeping tariffs on countries around the world. Coming up, we'll be joined by economist Dean Baker to talk about it. We'll also take your phone calls and emails. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. President Zelensky of Ukraine says two Chinese citizens have been captured while fighting for Russia in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region. It's the first official allegation that China is supplying Russia with manpower. Mr. Zelensky has demanded an answer from Beijing. China has repeatedly denied allegations that it's supplying Russia with military equipment, but James Waterhouse in Kyiv says their relationship is undoubtedly close.
When it comes to China and Russia, before the full-scale invasion, they talked about a relationship with no limits against external threats. What they meant was America. China